From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Indonesia's much-anticipated new cabinet draws mixed reviews. Tech-savvy South Korea tries to recycle more e-waste. Overcoming gender-based violence and discrimination in Asia. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee's majority Democratic staff has released a report outlining their suggestions on Afghanistan reconstruction spending. The report says a higher proportion of U.S. assistance should be conditioned on specific reforms by the Afghan government, especially efforts to confront corruption and stem the country's illicit drug trade. It says future assistance should be allocated based on how the new Afghan government appoints top positions within key ministries and calls on the government to appoint genuine reformers. The committee says the U.S. must maintain the highest standards in ensuring security assistance recipients do not violate human rights. It notes concerns by the United Nations and other humanitarian organizations on reports of rights violations by members of Afghan security forces. According to the World Bank, the United States, along with other international donors, fund nearly 60% of Afghanistan's yearly $7.6 billion budget. The report comes out a week before midterm elections, which could see Republican senators gain a majority, potentially replacing Democratic lawmakers at the helm of the Foreign Relations Committee. After his first week as Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo has unveiled his much-anticipated new cabinet. Analysts say the choices reveal both potential innovation and heavy political compromise. Kate Lamb has this report from Jakarta.
Since the beginning of his political career, former small-town mayor, now president, Joko Widodo, has worked hard to separate himself from Indonesia's political pack. In his first week in office, the new president has sought to build on this unique political identity. In a country known for its rampant corruption, President Widodo took the unprecedented move of having his cabinet picks vetted by the National Anti-Graft Body. That process led to continued delays, resulting in 8 ministerial candidates axed from the initial lineup. After a week of intense speculation, President Widodo's 34 new ministers in his so-called working cabinet were announced on Sunday afternoon and inaugurated in a televised ceremony at the State Palace on Monday. Ministers took the oath of office, pledging to follow the law and reject bribes. The cabinet is a mixed bag of technocrats, businesspeople and a few admired reformers, what Keith Lovard, a risk analyst from Concord Consulting, described as a wait-and-see cabinet.
The tone of the cabinet lifts then. I mean, obviously there are some sort of elite members of the elite, and there are some people with questionable human rights backgrounds, as you one would expect in Indonesia. But there is also this new blood, as it were, with this new spirit of entrepreneurial talent there.
The cabinet includes several entrepreneurs, including airline owner Susi Pujiastuti, who, while successful in business, are so far unproven in government. Mr. Widodo, a former furniture entrepreneur, has promised to reform the bureaucracy, streamline red tape and target an economic growth rate of 7% in Southeast Asia's largest economy. A newly created Coordinating Maritime Affairs Ministry is also expected to help realise the president's much-touted vision to transform Indonesia into a global maritime axis. Among the cabinet picks that have garnered the most praise is the choice for State Secretary Pratikno, the rector of Gajah Mada University, and Anis Baswadan, the reform-minded rector of Paramedina University, a key advisor to Mr. Widodo during his campaign, who will be the Minister of Primary and Secondary Education. Retno Lestari Priyansari Masudi, a respected career diplomat, has been named foreign minister, the first Indonesian woman to assume the position. Masudi, a former ambassador to the Netherlands, Iceland and Norway, is one of 8 women in the new administration, also a record for Indonesia. However, among the new faces, analysts have criticised the number of political appointments, particularly of figures close to Megawati Sukarnoputri, the chairwoman of Mr. Widodo's PDIP party. Siti Zuro, an analyst from the Indonesian Institute of Sciences, says the cabinet lineup indicates that Mr. Widodo, widely known by his nickname Jokowi, is not entirely independent.
I think there is no question about the role of Madam Megawati Sukarnoputri. She played an important role in, let's say, in appointing, in recruiting the candidates, I think. Jokowi is, yes, I think he has his authority to choose, his minister, but still, he should ask Megawati Sukarnoputri to, to agree or disagree. I think that now Jokowi cannot, cannot decide without asking permission from Ibu Megawati.
Throughout his campaign and post-election, President Widodo consistently maintained that he would not trade ministerial positions for political support. Yet, a handful of elites in his party have been awarded coveted positions, including Megawati's daughter, Puan Marani, who will oversee one of four coordinating ministries, and Riyamzad Rayakudu, a former general with a questionable human rights record, who is now the defence minister. Rini Sumano, a so-called Megawati confidant and former trade minister, has also been named the next state-owned enterprises minister. Analysts say these appointments reflect an inevitable pragmatism, but inhibit Mr. Widodo's efforts to generate excitement about his government. 21 of 34 ministers in the Widodo cabinet are either connected to a party or linked to senior party officials. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
Pakistan's military says airstrikes have killed at least 33 suspected terrorists in parts of North Waziristan. An army statement says the strikes near the Afghan border destroyed 9 terrorist hideouts. Pakistan has been carrying out a major military offensive in North Waziristan since June. Authorities say more than 1,100 militants have been killed. The military says it has cleared major towns of extremist networks accused of carrying out deadly attacks on both sides of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Pakistan's army has also recently started an operation against militants in the nearby border district of Khyber Agency, where authorities suspect that Islamist fighters fleeing the Waziristan offensive have taken refuge. The latest round of aerial strikes in Khyber took place Sunday and killed at least 18 militants. Civil society and human rights groups in Myanmar, also known as Burma, are urging the government to fully investigate the death of a journalist while in military custody. Aung Kwan Yong, also known as Pargi, a Burmese-language freelance journalist, was arrested September 30th after reporting on clashes between government troops and current ethnic fighters. Last week, the army announced he had been shot and killed by a guard while trying to escape. Local authorities have promised to conduct a full investigation. China is considering scrapping 9 crimes from its list of offenses punishable by death. The official Xinhua news agency said Monday a draft amendment to reduce the scope of capital punishment has been submitted to the National People's Congress. Currently, 55 offenses are eligible for the death penalty. Crimes that would be exempt from capital punishment under the amendment include smuggling weapons, ammunition, or nuclear materials, counterfeiting currency, and raising funds by illegal means. The San Francisco-based Dihua Foundation, which seeks the release of political prisoners in China, says China executed 2,400 people in 2013 and is expected to execute a similar number this year. The exact number is considered a state secret, and rights groups say China executes more people than the rest of the world combined. A Japanese automaker is at the center of a global recall of millions of defective automobile airbags. At least 4 deaths and a dozen injuries have been blamed on the faulty devices manufactured by Takata Corporation. The airbags explode with so much force they send flying shrapnel or pieces of sharp metal at the driver and any other occupants in the car. Takata says the problem is caused by high humidity, which causes the chemical propellant that inflates the airbag to explode. Between 12 and 16 million automobiles with the defective airbags have been recalled since the problem was first detected back in 2008, with at least 10 million of them sold in the United States. Models from at least 10 automakers are involved in the recall, including Honda, Toyota, Nissan, and BMW. Japanese officials are in Pyongyang to receive an update on North Korea's investigation into the fate of Japanese citizens abducted decades ago. The delegation is holding talks during a four-day visit with a North Korean Special Investigation Committee on the abduction issue. North Korea has admitted to kidnapping Japanese citizens during the 1970s to train its spies. The North has repatriated five Japanese citizens, but claims that a dozen more have died. Japan has pressed for more information about the abductees' fate and others that Tokyo believes were also kidnapped. South Korean prosecutors demanded the death penalty Monday for the captain of the Sewol ferry that sank in April, killing more than 300 people. They also demanded life sentences for three senior crew members of the ship. The prosecutors sought lesser sentences between 15 and 30 years for the remaining 11 crew members. The captain and 14 crew members of the South Korean ferry who were in court in Gwangju Monday were among the first people to leave the sinking ferry. The crew has been charged with abandoning the Sewol ferry after repeatedly telling passengers, many of them high school students, to stay on the vessel. Ferry victim family members were present Monday in the courtroom. South Korea, meanwhile, is coping with increased amounts of garbage from electronic devices, also called e-waste. To prevent tons of old computers, smartphones, and appliances from ending up in landfills, leaking toxic chemicals, some local governments are launching specialized e-waste recycling programs. From Seoul, reporter Jason Strother tells us more.
Seoul City throws out some 10 tons of broken, outdated, and unwanted electronics each year. Here at the SR Center, devices are taken apart so that valuable metals like gold, copper, or rare earths can be extracted, a $3.8 billion industry, according to the government. But it is not just about earning profits, says the center's CEO, Jiun Goon. It is about protecting the environment.
Our planet has a limited amount of natural resources. Our company contributes to a sustainable society by conserving these materials.
Ji says about 90% of what is brought here gets recycled. Accumulating mounds of electronic trash is not only a concern in technologically advanced South Korea. The United Nations reports millions of tons of the world's e-waste winds up in developing countries. There, toxic materials like lead and mercury pose a severe health risk. That is despite international agreements that ban the export of discarded electronics. Since 2009, the Seoul City government has partnered with the SR Center to collect e-waste from the public and private sectors. Seoul's Lee Tae-hoon says recycling is also a security matter in the digital age.
If devices like phones are not recycled, then they could illegally end up in other countries like China or in Southeast Asia, and personal data could be stolen.
Even though recycling centers like this limit the amount of landfill-bound electronics, it is not enough, according to some environmental watchdog groups. Digitally savvy South Koreans keep buying more gadgets. In the end, some estimate that about 21% of the country's total e-waste actually gets properly recycled. That is according to Lee Ju-hong of the Green Consumers Network. He says the average South Korean purchases a new mobile phone every 1.5 years.
People change their phones so quickly, partially because companies offer big subsidies to buy new products. And Korean consumers do not want to feel left out by not having the latest model.
Jiun Goon of Seoul's recycling center agrees that consumer habits are a big reason why old phones keep piling up here. But he says he is doing his part to reduce that.
I have had this phone for 10 years. It is what I can do to help conserve our natural resources.
Ji says more South Korean cities need to start their own recycling programs to keep up with the increasing loads of e-waste. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
The rapid growth of the Asian population in and around Houston, Texas, has helped make the fourth largest city in the United States one of the country's most diverse cities. Many Asians come to Houston to fill high-paying jobs in the city's energy and medical sectors, but many also come to start businesses in a relatively inexpensive city. As VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Houston, the Asian influx has also helped one Chinese immigrant build an empire.
Chinese culture is now woven into Houston's urban fabric. But young Chinese residents are also proud to be Texans. One of them is China-born entrepreneur Wei Li, who founded Southern News Group here 35 years ago.
Our friends get together here. Also celebrate 35-year anniversary of a Southern News Group.
Li's business success started with this printing press and a newspaper for the then small Chinese community in Houston. He now has huge modern presses and publishes community papers in several languages in 10 U.S. cities.
Every hour, I could print about 28,000 copies.
The 70% growth in Houston's Asian population since the year 2000 has fueled the expansion of Li's business. He now prints papers in several Asian languages. Houston's Asian population, at about 7%, is small compared to whites and Hispanics, each over 40%, but Asians tend to be well-educated and wealthier. Wei Li says his publications have helped many immigrants prosper.
A lot of people move to Houston, move to international district. We try to help them to become their home, to get a successful their business.
He has also expanded into television and the internet, providing entertainment and news for the Chinese community.
And since Chinese food is popular around the world, ITV has a cooking show.
In cooperation with a TV station in Los Angeles, the Houston Channel provides all-day programming. ITV also offers an internet news program for China, where news announcer Tongyan Zhang says there is great interest in Houston.
People living in China, in Beijing, in Shanghai, they all want to know, is Houston is a great city for them to invest in? Is Houston is a great city for them to come to find a job, to go to college?
We have a lot of our program related to education, how to get into high school, how to get to the best college in America. That kind of topic interested a lot of Chinese audience.
Aside from his media empire, Wei Li's company also owns the International Trade Center in Houston's Chinatown, and he was a major partner in establishing a local bank.
We really appreciate this great country give us opportunity. You know, where else you can start a banking business? Where else you can start a publishing business? Only happen in America.
Houston's Asian population is growing 50% faster than more established hubs like New York or San Francisco, and Southern News Group will benefit from that growth in the years ahead. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
The world watched in horror earlier this year as two girls in India were gang-raped and hanged in Uttar Pradesh. The stories of sexual violence in India has been played out in newspaper headlines around the world since the 2012 gang rape and murder of a student on a Delhi bus. Michelle Rickett is the founder of She Is Safe. Rickett tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso that gender-based violence and discrimination against women in Asia is deeply entrenched. In her latest book, Forgotten Girls, Stories of Hope and Courage, she has put forth the inspiring stories of courage and hope of young girls being rescued and having their lives restored.
Asia in particular, it really is considered the most dangerous region in the world for women and girls. Even before they are born, fetuses are targeted, female fetuses, for extinction. We are missing 200 million girls in this world through sex-selective abortion in China and India. If they survive that, many are starved, strangled, or buried alive. We actually have stories in the book of a girl who was buried alive and dug up and rescued by her grandfather. So the challenges begin very early in life. Then if a girl overcomes those early challenges, generally she is not fed the protein that her brothers are fed and she will be underdeveloped. If she survives that, she will be generally kept out of school and she will be a worker at home caring for younger siblings. siblings or working in a factory or in the fields, and then perhaps sold into marriage or sold outright into some kind of servitude. There is a district in Nepal that is known for being the hub of organized crime, where girls are routinely sold by the time they turn 12 years old. So there are whole villages we've been to that have literally no girls over the age of 12 because organized crime is there, and it's just considered something of a badge of honor that the girls are so beautiful, so sought after. There are three villages of about 300 people, and we began talking to the women and asked them what life was like when they grew up and what did they think that's happened to their daughters who are gone. And boy, the stories began to roll out and their heartache over the situation. And just in allowing the women to begin to talk and tell what they really feel, they draw themselves together and come to the conclusion that these practices have to stop.
Could you share with us a story that particularly stands out from any of the young ladies in Asia?
I would focus on a girl named Nima. When I met her, she was about 17 years old. She had been rescued at one of the She Is Safe-sponsored border rescue stations. So we have these stations at the border between Nepal and India. She said, "I'm so sick and tired of what I'm doing. I just need help. Can you help me?" Her story began when she was 5 years old. She was being abused by her dad, and she had a three-year-old sister. She said, "I rescued us. We ran away from home into the woods. We lived in a hollowed-out tree for a while. I begged for food for us, and eventually a woman in the market took my sister and left me on the street, and she became a domestic servant. She was very disappointing as a servant, and so the family began using her as a sex slave. Before she was 15, she had become drug and alcohol dependent and had two children. When we met her, she was a recruiter. She was going back from India into Nepal to recruit girls. And when we gave her the opportunity just to tell us her story, and of course she was not in good shape physically. So we have a safe house where we took her in Kathmandu, and there she began to grow healthy and just have a new sense of purpose and mission to rescue and restore other girls. She said, "You know, all my life, I think I was made to be a rescuer from the time I wanted to rescue my own sister. Now I want to go into villages, talk to families about what can happen when girls go to India for a job, and I'd like to train them in some kind of skill so that the family sees these girls are assets. You don't want to let them go." She has been tremendously successful at protecting and rescuing and encouraging families to not sell their daughters as she was sold.
Why is it important for people to know about these stories of these young ladies?
The issues that we're talking about can seem overwhelming, even paralyzing. When you think of 27 to 30 million slaves in the world, what can we possibly do about that? But when you actually see the life journey of someone who it seems that the world has thrown the worst at them, and yet they are able to forge a new life and even have a great sense of passion and purpose. So getting the real information about what really needs to happen in order to make a difference, I think helps us create a movement of real change.
Michelle Rickett, founder of She Is Safe, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Frances Alonzo. And be sure to hear Frances's reports each week on her Women Rising series. You can find the latest world news just by continuing to listen to our stream. Steve Norman is next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years,